This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
On the Roblox platform, chats and interaction are the name of the game. And for safety online, Roblox has introduced an age estimation tool. It's required for teens to access unfiltered private messaging and voice chats, and it helps to ensure online acquaintances are the age they say they are. Roblox using selfie technology and AI systems to try to determine whether a player is over the age of 13.
Obviously, we can't estimate someone's age perfectly, but we can get really close.
Age verification, estimation, or inference is seemingly all the rage right now. Vendors are promoting it as the solution to thorny challenges to limit access to certain sites and services, and politicians seem eager to legislate in that direction. As listeners of this podcast will know, the Canadian experience with these technologies can currently be found in Bill S-209, which would mandate its use across a wide range of sites. Hundreds of scientists and technology experts from around the world have taken note of the trend and come together to issue a public letter warning about the privacy, safety, and discriminatory risks associated with these technologies. Ian Goldberg, who holds the Canada Research Chair in Privacy Enhancing Technologies at the University of Waterloo, was one of the signatories. Ian has long been engaged at the intersection between technology and privacy, and he joins the podcast to discuss the tech, how privacy enhancing technologies could address some of the concerns, and the risks with the current legislative approaches. Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming on. You know, age verification and age assurance technologies are really, I think, one of the hot issues of the moment. I've covered it fairly regularly in the context of Bill S-209 that would mandate these technologies to access adult content. Unfortunately, I think some of the broad definitions in that bill means that they'd cover far more than adult sites with search engines, social media sites, and AI services, even potentially targeted. Now, that bill is still working its way through the Senate and may ultimately still go to the House. But one of the big lingering issues, I think, involves the technology itself and the risks that it may pose. Now, scientists around the world have begun to speak out on this issue, and you were one of them, one of hundreds of experts that signed on to an open public letter that laid out the concerns with these technologies. You know, I want to get into some of the concerns in the letter, but if you can provide a bit of a background on this initiative that led so many scientists and experts to speak out.
Yeah, so as you've said, Bill S-209 is an initiative in Canada toward age verification, age assurance technologies. But of course, this is happening in many jurisdictions around the world. So we've seen it come up in the UK. It's been proposed in Europe. Many US states have, a few have already been enacted, and several more are in the pipeline. So this is happening all over the place. But because Europe was starting to talk about it, a team of researchers that are mainly centered in Europe got together to put together this letter, raise concerns, particularly about mandating technologies whose problems outweigh their benefits.
I'll link, obviously, to the letter in the show notes. There are hundreds of people from around the world that have signed on. I want to touch on some of the policy concerns, of course. But before we do that, let's deal with some of the technology-related issues. It's relatively rare for me, and it's a real treat to have someone who's got some of the technology chops like you do. So when we're talking about age assessment, as you called it, or age assurance technologies, what are we talking about? How do these technologies typically function?
Yeah, so they're largely, you can divide it into three categories. Okay, so let's talk about each one. So the first one is commonly called age verification technologies. So this is usually something along the lines of you upload your passport or your driver's license or some government issue ID, you upload it to a site, and they somehow check that it's valid and certify that you are this old. right? Of course, all they're really certifying is that you uploaded a photo, or maybe there's a better, some better technology to prove you didn't forge the photo or something like that. But all it really proves is that at some point you had access to the ID of an adult, right? Or of a child. We'll talk more about that later. But some of these technologies are meant to be used to prove you are a child in order to give you access to like child-only chat rooms, like in Roblox, for example, right? And that has a lot of more complicated concerns, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. So age verification is about taking some usually government-issued document and verifying that the document says you are a certain age, or that the owner of the document is a certain age. It is a completely separate question to ask, is the person sitting in front of the computer right now the same person that it owns the passport? Okay, so the second category is age estimation. So age estimation directly tackles that question about the person sitting in front of the computer. What it does, it turns on your webcam and it looks at you and it uses some algorithm to say you look like an adult or you look like a child. The accuracy of those is, of course, questionable. How easy is it to trick is questionable. We'll surely talk about those in more detail later. But that's largely the second class. It's just looking at a picture or a video of you and just trying to guess how old you are, at least broadly, right? It won't be too specific. And of course, when you're near the borderline, it's going to be wildly inaccurate, right? And then the last one is age inference. So age inference is where they collect a lot of information about your behavior. So what websites you visit, what links you click, the contents of your chats, perhaps. So it uses all kinds of information about your online activities in order to try to guess how old you are. So these are largely the three classes: age verification, age estimation, age inference. As I said, the mandates are already in place in some jurisdictions. So some of these technologies have already rolled out because they are legally required to. There have been some spectacular failures that we'll surely talk about in a bit. And of course, if more countries or states mandate these technologies, their deployments will, of course, only get more prevalent.
Let's talk a little bit more. I just want to drill down on a couple of those. With respect to the age estimation, now the use case, at least that we see with much of this, is to sort of essentially say, you're either in or you're out. You're either an adult or you're not. Or as you mentioned, and it's something that doesn't get a lot of attention, you're a kid or you're not. You know, just to be clear, just how accurate can you possibly be where you're trying to estimate, say, between a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old? I mean, that would be, yes, that'd be difficult to do in human terms when you're looking at a classroom where you may have a mix of students. You wouldn't necessarily know how old they are. How can a computer do it even better in terms of just a photo that's taken in this kind of context?
Yeah, unsurprisingly, almost certainly not better at all, right? So it can probably sensibly distinguish between a 40-year-old and a 13-year-old, and possibly some more narrow ranges than that. When you're near the edge, as you say, even a human has no chance. And even worse, they're easy to trick. So if you are actively trying to deceive the algorithm, it will be easy to do so.
It also does strike me, and this kind of can lead us into some of the privacy-related issues, that one of the things that I imagine likely happens in situations where it is difficult to sort of come up with a number that is reliable is that you begin to look for other kinds of information. The exactly sort of the inference-related issues that you just started, that you talked about as another mechanism to do this. I'm wondering, do you start finding that there is a blending of these different approaches where if it's more difficult just based merely on an estimation basis, well, then you say, all right, let's take a deeper look as to everything we can know about this person to try to get a better sense of how old they likely are based on the kind of language they use or the sites they visit, or perhaps require some actual identification, in which case you're suddenly now layering in all sorts of additional privacy issues as part of an effort to try to figure out how old the person happens to be.
It's true that you'll probably do some combination of these three kinds of age verification, age estimation, and age inference. You might try a age estimation. If you're clearly 40, you might say that's good enough. But if the algorithm decides it needs more information, yeah, you might have to upload your passport, or it might go through all your emails and or your chats or whatever.
So it clearly raises an assortment of privacy issues. And say, we'll have a chance to talk a bit more about that. But your area of expertise as the Canada Research Chair in Privacy Enhancing Technologies, in many ways, is the flip of this. It's using technologies to seek to provide or enhance privacy. Can you talk a little bit more about what privacy enhancing technologies are all about?
Yeah, sure. So privacy enhancing technologies, or we call them PETs for short, they're broadly what they say on the tin, right? They're technologies that help people, individuals, typically protect their privacy, usually in online settings is where we focus our attention. The most commonly used privacy-enhancing technology in the world is just the HTTPS secure web browsing that you, your listeners, are almost surely using right now, right? So like 15 years ago, most websites were accessible only in a completely unprotected, not private fashion. So like the plain HTTP, if you look at your URL bar in your web browser, right? But then in 2013, the Snowden revelations pushed technologists to deploy the more secure and private HTTPS, the S stands for security, technology, quickly and widely. And today it's actually pretty weird to encounter a website that doesn't use HTTPS, right? So that was one big success story of deploying privacy-enhancing technologies. But largely, indeed, what I study are algorithms, protocols, building systems to allow people to communicate, transact, be online, be in online spaces, while being able to protect their privacy in where that is taken very broadly, as I said before.
How, if at all, do PETs play a role as part of this discussion around age assurance technologies? Have they been factored in to age assurance, age estimation, these technologies altogether?
As you pointed out earlier, there are a lot of privacy issues with some of these technologies, and privacy-enhancing technologies, or PETs, can be used to protect your privacy while these age verification technologies are in use. So as an example, so let's look at age verification where they're looking at your passport or something like that. So you could at least in theory use a privacy-enhancing technology there to allow a person to prove that, for example, they have a passport in their possession that shows they are over 16 or whatever age your cutoff is, without revealing any other information, including their identity or even their specific age. So your computer will interact with your passport and basically upload a proof to the service that it interacted with the passport, it decided you were over 16, or at least the passport is owned by a person who is over 16, and the site can check that proof and be assured there was really a passport there. You don't have to trust the computer isn't lying. The proof actually is sound. That would be useful. Of course, like I said before, checking that the person sitting in front of the computer right now is the same person that owns the passport, completely separate question. if that could be done at all, and that's a non-trivial if, then we know that using privacy-enhancing technologies, you could do it in a private manner. So if you had some algorithm for looking at the webcam or something, and if you could prove that that was the same person as owned the passport, and the passport says you were whatever age, you could prove all this privately. We call it in zero knowledge, the details aren't important. But the upshot is that any computational analysis that can be done on the end user's device that they control could be enhanced with privacy-enhancing technologies to be done privately. But the tricky, well, there are several tricky bits, but a tricky bit is that requires the end user to have a device they trust in the first place, and possibly a pretty powerful one at that, right? So it's maybe not for everyone, especially possibly in the scenario where you're trying to prove you are a child. Children are less likely to have personal devices. They're more likely to be using family computers or something like that, right? And that is a whole extra problem. And of course, while privacy-enhancing technologies might work for some kinds of age verification like this, it also doesn't really help that much when age inference is being done using data collected and especially collected non-privately about the user and stored on a server somewhere.
There's potential there, but clearly challenges along the way. Do we see, to your knowledge, any of the attempts to mandate these kinds of technologies account for the aspect that pets might mitigate against some of the privacy risks? Or for the moment, is the approach basically, you've got to employ some of these technologies and it's left to the providers to decide, I suppose, whether or not they're going to embed their tech with some of the kinds of assurances or some of the protections that you've just talked about?
Yeah, so none of the laws that have passed, to my knowledge, mandate the use of privacy-enhancing technologies as part of the age assurance systems. In kind of related areas, like Europe has these proposals for the European digital identity and things like that, and those actually are more privacy friendly. So you can do the kinds of proof, privacy preserving proofs I talked about in order to prove things about your identity privately, but the European age assurance laws are not even yet written. To my knowledge, the point of this letter was to kind of pump the brakes on that before it got too far.
Your focus is on the pet side, sort of using technology to try to address some of the privacy-related concerns. Can you highlight some of the other privacy-related issues that might arise, even beyond the fact that you can mitigate against some of these issues? What are some of the other privacy-related concerns that have been identified associated with these technologies?
Yeah, sure. So, like we intimated, lots. So let's talk about some examples. So the potential privacy harms, they'll vary according to the type of age assurance technology we're talking about. So with age verification, you're checking typically some government document, usually by uploading it to some server somewhere, right? And we saw spectacular failure of privacy with Discord a few months back. Where they were collecting people's ID. And it wasn't Discord, it was a third-party service, right? Because that's how all of this works. The sites you're actually interacting with aren't typically the ones doing the age assurance. They just contracted out to some third party who you've never even heard of, right? And so you're uploading your IDs to them, and then what happened? They got hacked, and they were storing everyone's IDs, and now everyone's IDs were stolen by the attackers, right? So that's not great. With age inference, the service is, of course, collecting lots of information about you in order to make privacy-violating decisions about you, right? So that is unaccountably or in ways that violate your autonomy. And Like I said, usually this is by third-party service providers. They're not the site you're actually trying to use. And you as an end user typically have no idea who these organizations are that are collecting your personal information, let alone how they're using it or how their use will affect you, right? There's also the problem that governments could see privacy tools such as virtual private networks or VPNs as methods that people could use to protect their privacy, but also to bypass the age assurance privacy harms, right? The governments could then aim to restrict these general use privacy tools, like we saw the UK government proposed last month for VPNs. And that kind of went under the radar for a lot of people. The letter actually links to that announcement from the UK government that they'll be looking into restricting VPNs. The mandating of privacy harmful age assurance technologies then has a knock-on problem of reducing online privacy for things that have nothing to do with age estimation, right? And also remember that the whole point of these systems is to distinguish children from non-children. So they're going to be collecting a large amount of sensitive personal information about children, which is even more problematic.
It's a big list. It's easy to immediately see where some of the harms arise. And incredibly, the concerns that, you know, that have been identified when people talk about these technologies and these issues, including in the letter, aren't even limited to privacy. I know there have been references to things like discrimination and risks to online safety as well. You know, what are some of the examples that might arise in that context?
Yeah, so the letter talks about a number of such other concerns, not just privacy. So depending on, again, the type of age assurance being used, some people may not have the required kind of ID, right? Not have a smartphone or a particular kind of smartphone, not even have digital literacy, right? So requiring age assurance to use a site will lock out many adults who, while not being children, do not have the ability for whatever reason to complete the age assurance process, right? So examples used in the expert letter include the elderly, visitors from another country without the expected government ID, the incarcerated, people who can't financially afford it, and so on, right? As for online safety, the very last thing we want is for children to be unable to access mainstream sites because they've added these age assessment technologies, and then they get pushed towards fringe sites that don't participate in the age assurance system, but also don't have protections against things like malware, scams, and misinformation, and that don't fall under the data protection laws of jurisdictions like Canada and Europe.
It's notable that, you know, a number of the examples you've raised, both when you talk about privacy and then you start talking about online safety and harms, that ultimately it's kids who are, of course, supposed to be the beneficiary of this. I mean, so much of this is designed to protect kids, and it sounds like there are ultimately some really significant risks that actually are specific to children who may find themselves the most vulnerable coming out of some of this. You've got expertise on the technology side. Just how feasible is the deployment of this kind of technology at all, right? So you get politicians, and in the Canadian context, obviously, so far it's been senators who are running on the assumption that, of course, this is doable. Egged on at times, it feels like those that actually sell these technologies, and they sort of say industry associations that say, hey, our members stand ready to do this. All you have to do is legislate it and we're good to go. But once you talk to people with some technical expertise, it gets a bit more complicated. You know, what is likely to happen, or what are some of the challenges that arise from a deployment perspective?
Even aside from the situations where parents actively help their children circumvent the age assurance tech, so there's now lots of documentation now that Australia, for example, has implemented the social media ban for under 16s. Even apart from that, the current technologies have proved pretty easy to get around, right? And as the letter notes, even when the children themselves, like, it's not just that the children themselves are figuring out how to get around this. It's either older children or adults create instructions or offer services to help them, right? So the children who want to get around it just have to be able to find these instructions or use this website in order to get around the age assurance technology. We even saw examples, like I said, age estimation technology, where they're trying to figure out your age just from the video of you. Super easy to fool. Someone like drew a fake mustache and beard and tricked the system that way. And when age verification is used in the other direction to prove you are a child, it's even less effective, right? Because now you have adults who are trying to trick the system into thinking they are a child. And that's more straightforward because the adults have more resources and more ability to do this. And worse, this results in a false sense of security, where parents wrongly think that a particular space is safe for their children.
You know, I mentioned that much of this has unfolded with politicians basically saying, well, you know, if you build it, it'll work, to do a bit of a riff on the, sort of the Field of Dreams approach. You know, why don't we conclude with this? I mean, it's obvious that the experts have real concerns with this. And I have to say that, I've having closely followed the debates on S-209 and its predecessor legislation, some of these issues, not all of them, I think this has been a really helpful discussion to identify a number of issues that frankly haven't come before committee, but some of them have. And the response, I have to say, invariably is that the technology can be fixed. You know, what Cory Doctorow sometimes would say, just nerd harder, you know, work harder, tech people, and you can fix some of these issues. You've been sort of at that intersection between policy, technology, and the law for a long time, especially from a privacy perspective. What are some of your thoughts on how politicians tend to deal with technology, often not looking to deal with technology as it is, but rather it seems as they wish it would be?
Yeah, so one big issue here is that they're trying to solve a social problem with technology, and that pretty much never works, right? This social problem that they often cite is like children's mental health or safety from predators and things like that. The letter, in fact, cites some scientific studies that report no evidence that banning teens from accessing social media improves their mental health outcomes. The letter posits that it's not wise to mandate a technology that at this time is easy to bypass, but at the same time has detrimental effects while not being known to achieve the desired target of protecting children from mental health concerns, predators, and so on. The letter proposes conducting in-depth studies of the benefits and harms of using age assessment technologies before those technologies see widespread deployment. The sites are dangerous for children to use. That seems more like a site problem than a children problem, right? And of course, we see with things like AI psychosis, that's been getting some press recently, that these sites aren't necessarily safe for adults either, right? So fixing the sites, whether by regulation or other means, so that they're not harmful to children or adults, seems like a better plan than these age estimation technologies. And the letter explicitly proposes tackling the root of the harm. They cite the Council of Europe's Commissioner for Human Rights, and for example, they propose looking at the social media site algorithms that prioritize engagement, even if such engagement stems from promoting harmful content. But getting politicians and technologists to understand each other is, of course, a long-standing problem, as you all know, right? And there are problems stemming from all sides. So as you say, the politicians want tech to be magic and to just do what they want. But technologists often uphold their technologies, especially the ones selling something, unrealistically as solutions to social problems, to get the contracts, to get the technologies they sell mandated by law or for whatever reason. Technologies are great tools and they can sometimes do surprising things. But the technology cycle is many years long. Mandating a technology that doesn't currently exist in an effective and non-detrimental form doesn't make sense. Technology improves. I don't actually think the term you use, nerd harder, is wrong on its face, right? We do nerd harder as technologists, and we do improve technology. But the improvements are not usually linear or easily predictable. The politicians and lawmakers have to wait for the nerd hardering to be done, right? And to demonstrably produce effective and non-detrimental outcomes before they can treat those new technologies as something that actually exists and is usable and useful and is available as one of many options in a regulatory landscape.
Yeah. Well, that's just so well said. You know, and unfortunately, it's the sort of thing that hasn't been raised, at least in the way that has convinced some of the senators, that they're simply looking for a solution. And as you suggest, are ahead at a sense of where the technology is, thinking that this will just sort itself out. But I think you've done a really nice job of highlighting why that's just not likely to be the case, because quite clearly there are real risks, and those risks are right now if we legislate right now. So Ian, thank you so much for the work that you do, for nerding harder, so to speak, when it comes to privacy enhancing technologies, and for joining me here on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at LawBitesPod, or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca, or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.